You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. On this Memorial Day, you might be tempted to visit a park or natural area in the state. A lot of people had that idea last year, driven in part by the pandemic. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources said 20.6 million people headed to state park system properties, up 3 million from the previous year. But with all of those visitors, many of them first-timers, came opportunities for problems. Some seemingly small, like not following proper trail etiquette. Others are more serious, like leaving trash behind. So the DNR is offering three words of encouragement to make natural areas enjoyable for everyone. Leave no trace. Missy Van Landit is the Recreation Partnership's section chief with the Wisconsin State Parks System. I talked to Missy in April to learn more about how people can treat our parks with respect. Here's our conversation. Are you expecting another big year for state park attendance?
You know, we are. We're preparing for at least what we saw last year. And right now we're actually trending even more than that. The first few months of 2021 have shown about a 25% increase over 2019. So even bigger than last year, but we're getting prepared.
And last year we had some COVID restrictions related to the parks. Any COVID related policies that people need to know about this year?
Yeah, you know, a lot of it is pretty similar to last year. Most of our facilities are still closed with the exception of restrooms, especially in the campgrounds. But all of our restrooms will be open for this year. Our nature centers, office buildings, things like that are still closed. A couple good things, though, we are opening up our standalone concession facilities to 50% occupancy. So our concessions will virtually be back to normal. We are also opening up our towers and playgrounds as of April 30th, and we're increasing our capacity for open air shelters, outdoor group camps, and amphitheaters from 50 to 100. So we're continuing on the spectrum, and you know, we're always evaluating our operations and continuing to open things up as we can safely do so.
And before we get into the rules of the road, could you make the case for people getting out into nature, whether it's the state park or a local space in their community?
You know, everybody seems to be loving the outdoors lately, which is great for us. And, you know, it really can fulfill that mental, social, you know, physical wellness aspects and even the emotional wellness piece. You know, getting outside can be healing for so many. And we're just glad that there's so much public land in Wisconsin for people to enjoy.
Now, you're glad, as you say, people are checking out state parks. But, you know, a lot of people, 20 million visits, it could take a toll on landscape, ecosystems, fellow visitors. Can you talk about the sort of things that you worry about if parks are overused and not used, I guess, with wise stewardship?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of things, you know, especially some of the things that we saw last year, which get to some of those, you know, leave no trace principles. But, you know, a big one is people staying where there are designated areas. So that means parking in designated parking areas and camping in designated camping areas and staying on the trails. That is a really big thing that we see right now, especially with spring and the mud. So many people are out and about and they maybe don't want to get their shoes dirty, so they go around the mud. And actually that causes more damage, not only to habitat and plants, but it can also widen the trail. It can make it unstable and essentially could cause more repair and need, you know, more repair and damages down the road. So a big thing is just going where you're allowed to go and not going where you're not allowed to go.
And yeah, I think sometimes people might be tempted to think, oh, if just I do it, just one person does it, it goes off the trail, it's not a big deal. But it can be a little deal and it can really add up fast, I imagine.
Exactly. Because then, you know, other folks start to see, well, they did it, it must be okay, so I can do it. And we certainly saw that last year. And that's a lot of the reason why we ended up using different tools to manage our capacity, including capacity closures, which we're still expecting to use throughout, you know, periodically throughout the year this year, primarily in an effort not only for people to have the opportunity to safely social distance, but also realizing that, especially in the summer, those popular areas like beaches and trails, people are more drawn to those. And so we've reduced our capacity again to give people more of an opportunity to spread out on the landscape.
Talking to Missy Van Landit with the Wisconsin State Park System, looking at the joys of using our state parks and how to use them in ways that make them great places for years to come. Tell us a little, Missy, about the leave no trace concept.
Yeah, you know, there's seven general principles that people follow, you know, and I think they all apply to all of us, which is nice. And if you haven't heard of Leave No Trace, you maybe the hashtag Recreate Responsibly is going around now, or Responsible Recreation. And it's basically the same thing. And, you know, the first one is really just planning ahead. Know where you're going, know what you're doing. Be prepared for your visit. And, you know, that even goes for this time of year as we start to think about tick awareness and Lyme disease awareness. So just planning for your visit. The other one is what we just talked about, you know, going where you're supposed to go and not going where you're not supposed to go. A big one that we actually had a huge problem with last year was disposing of waste. So packing it in and packing it out. And, you know, utilizing, and this, it should go without saying, but utilizing the facilities that are available to you as humans. So making sure that you're utilizing those vault toilets and the toilet facilities when you need to, rather than other places. So that was actually a really big problem last year. And so many people not packing in and packing out like their granola bar wrappers and water bottles and things like that. So, you know, disposing of your waste properly. And leaving what you find where you find it, moving sticks and branches, you know, building structures, moving rocks, things like that is actually can be damaging to the environment and can damage valuable habitats. So leaving what you find where you find it is huge. And now with, you know, with it being fire season, there's a lot of burn bans everywhere. So minimizing the impacts of your campfire and being aware of burn bans in your area, and only having fires where it's permitted. We've had hundreds of wildfires across the state already this year. So, you know, that is really heightened awareness, especially in the dry spring that we've had.
Missy, one topic that came up for me and my wife actually just last weekend had to do with trail etiquette. Who has the right of way when you're going? I was at Devil's Lake. We left the right of way to the lake flies by the lake, went over to the Ice Age Trail. And, you know, who gives way to the other one? This being Wisconsin, the biggest risk is everybody's going to stand there and wait for the other person to go, and you'll be there all day. What is the right way to handle that?
You know, most of the time what you should do is you know, be courteous, yield to others. If you're going on the downhill side of the trail, you should be the one to yield to the people coming up. So definitely if you're, which I think I always want to do it the opposite way because I'm looking for a rest, right? So you're just like, oh, I want to wait. And, you know, that's fine. I'll pull over to the side here and let people come down. But it's actually the other way around. So if you're heading down, you yield to the people coming up. And again, that applies whether there's mud or otherwise. I think I've seen actually throughout the pandemic, a lot of people are wearing buffs or bringing their masks in their pockets. And that's a really good thing to make note of, is that if you're out on a trail and you can't distance, you can pop your buff up or your mask and go around people. And I think most people on trails have been very considerate of that as well.
Let's talk about keeping the right of way for wildlife. People want to treat animals well, and they might think that includes feeding them. I understand. No, not the best call there.
Not the best call there. And, you know, this is spring is the time for baby animals as well. And I think, you know, with our big hearts out there, people really want to rescue wildlife. So, you know, the DNR actually has the Leave Wildlife Wild campaign. And so leaving those animals alone, I think many people don't realize that the mothers or parents of those babies are out hunting or have distanced themselves from their babies to not attract predators. So just let wildlife be wild and don't feed it. Don't try to capture it. Don't take it anywhere. If you do find one that's injured, you can call our conservation wardens or other rescue centers, but otherwise leave wildlife wild.
And Missy, something I've enjoyed since last year now is finding either places I didn't know about or, you know, out of the way places that are off the beaten path, but still on a real path in the more famous state parks. Are there good ways to find those hidden gems that maybe not everybody knows about?
You know, absolutely. It's we have our Out We Go initiative, which is our initiative to have health and wellness in the outdoors. And if you go to the DNR webpage, dnr.wi.gov, and search Out We Go, which is OUTWIGO, we actually have coming up here in the next couple of weeks, you'll see a hidden gems graphic on there where you can find a hidden gem at every property. We're also launching in the next couple of weeks a search by activity function on that page. So you can search by whether you want to off-road bike, camp, hike, kayak, go to a beach, and you'll be able to search by activity. So check those things out. But our Out We Go page, we change seasonally and put up relevant information for helping you find those hidden gems.
One of my favorite things is finding hiking trails that are loops instead of, you know, going there and back or having to move a car or something like that. Looped trails or looped trails. Are there any good ways to find those awesome loops, Missy?
You know, each property has its own webpage on within the DNR webpage, so you can certainly find those. With the exception of our linear rail trails, which is 1,700 miles of kind of those one-way trails and the Ice Age Trail, most of our trails at properties are actually loop trails. And they encompass, you know, a big loop on the property where you can start and not have to retrace your steps. So all of that detailed trail information is on each of those property pages.
That was Missy Van Landit, Recreation Partnerships Section Chief with the Wisconsin State Park System. I talked to her in April about how people should leave no trace when visiting state parks. Sticking with the parks theme, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg.
My family likes to go camping a lot. And when I was a kid back in the 80s, one of our favorite spots was Devil's Lake. We hiked the bluffs and played games of 500 with a tennis ball at the beach. We dove into the water off a big flat boulder along the tumbled rocks trail we nicknamed the Big Kahuna. But there was a spot in the Quartzsite campground that blew my mind as a kid, and we called it the Hill That Goes Up That Goes Down. One weekend, our family was cruising up the middle lane of the campground on our bikes. The road up ahead appeared to rise slightly through a patch of woods, but as we made our way through the trees, we picked up speed and had to hit the brakes. That was weird. I looked back over my shoulder, and sure enough, we had just cruised up a little hill. For comment, let's go to Dan Kohlberg, my dad.
Yeah, I remember that. And we got down to the other end of the road and kind of said, wow, that was different. I mean, it looked like we were going to be going up a hill, and instead we coasted all the way here.
Back at the campsite, I remember my kid brain searching for an explanation. Was the spot enchanted by some sort of magic, magnetic, geologic, gravitational anomaly?
Regardless of what the cause is, I mean, it's like one of the seven wonders of Devil's Lake.
For the rest of the trip, my parents cooked dinner, sipped coffee, played cards, cracked peanuts. But my brother and I were back on our bikes, up, down. Up, down, eyes wide and laughing. So what was really happening there? Well, when I want to know something, but I don't want to Google it, I like to ask my old friend Bob Sundling, who's always known quite a bit about quite a lot.
Hey, Bob.
Hello, Brad. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
So Bob says that if the horizon is obscured, then other visual clues like trees tell us what the lay of the land really is.
But in an area with dominant winds, if the wind's always been blowing from one direction, all trees may have grown with a slight downwind lean. And it might only be a few degrees, but it's enough that our brains are thinking, oh, that's straight.
Huh.
We tend to think we have a good inherent ability to judge up and down and horizontal and vertical, but it really depends on these external clues.
Okay, so it's not that I was just riding my bike in some wonder spot.
Probably not. I mean, it is possible, for example, that there was, say, a black hole passing through the Earth's atmosphere at that time. And I think you would have probably noticed a few other strange things happening too, like, you know, maybe the end of the world or, you know, that type of thing.
The hill that goes up that goes down.
Last summer, on a camping trip to Devil's Lake, my daughter and I grabbed our bikes and headed up the middle lane of the Quartzsite campground. She'd heard all about this magic spot in the trees and wanted to try it out for herself.
It was pretty weird because by the looks of it, we should have been pedaling harder than usual to go up a hill, but when we actually got to it, it was easy coasting and we just went right down, even though it looked like we were going up. The hill that goes up that goes down.
Maybe we'll head back to Devil's Lake this summer and relive this goofy little bit of magic in our lives. It makes me grateful for this world that always seems to have a surprise waiting just up the road or down. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Goldberg.
Coming up, UW Green Bay is the newest member of the Bee City USA Club. We'll talk to a professor there about the state's honeybee population, how it's doing, and how the school is creating pollinator habitats. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to a special Memorial Day holiday edition of Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. The Bee City USA Club has a new member, UW Green Bay. It's joining the ranks as a campus affiliate. The designation is given to schools and cities that work to support bee populations through pollinator habitats and other projects. Amy Wolf is a professor of natural and applied sciences at UW Green Bay and an expert on the state's native pollinators. I talked to her in April about the designation. Here's our conversation. Amy, tell us about the projects you have going on at UW Green Bay aimed at helping our, especially I think, native bee populations here in the state.
Yeah, so we recently, as you mentioned, became a Bee Campus USA. And this is an initiative that is put out by the Xerces Society. And the Xerces Society is an international nonprofit organization focused on invertebrate conservation. So the aim really is to create this network of universities that partner as a community, which engages students and faculty and staff and administrators to work together on the common goal of native pollinator conservation. And we have just recently embarked on this. So we just recently have this designation. And as part of this partnership, institutions make certain commitments. So we have committed to creating and enhancing pollinator habitat by increasing the abundance of native plants and providing both nest and overwintering sites, to reduce the use of pesticides. So we're going to create and adopt an integrated pest management plan and hopefully reduce the overall pesticide use on campus. We're also committed to offering courses or continuing education opportunities that incorporate conservation of pollinators. And there are several other commitments that are part of this initiative of the Bee Campus USA, becoming a Bee Campus member.
Amy, when I think of bees, I think I'm like a lot of people, I picture the honeybee, but we have a lot more going on in Wisconsin in our native bee population. Can you introduce us to a state bee or two that might be helped by a project like this?
Yes, we have about 400 species of native bees in Wisconsin. They range from little tiny bees of pale colors, the Perdida, to large bees like our bumblebees. So yes, our most well-known bees are the honeybees and our bumblebees. So some of my favorite bees, one of my favorite bees or bee groups is the Osmia. So these bees are really pretty. They have metallic color. They're really round and cute looking. But we have bees that are metallic green. They're like race car green. We have others that are red with yellow zebra stripes. So we have, like I said, a really large diversity worldwide. There are about 20,000 bee species in the United States, about 3,600. And as I mentioned, in Wisconsin, we have around 400 species of bees that have been documented.
You mentioned, Amy, that students would be involved in the project. What kind of things will they do as part of the Bee Campus project?
Well, we have students on the committee. So we established a committee and met for the first time last week. So again, a really new initiative here. But students are going to be involved in maintaining our natural areas, enhancing native plant diversity. So we have students that work with our Cochrane Center for Biodiversity over the summer. And some of the things they're going to do this summer are in addition to controlling invasive species that reduce the overall plant resource diversity, they're going to enhance diversity in some of our prairie plantings and our oak savannas. In particular, they're going to increase the number of asclepias or milkweed species. Those are great species, as you know, for monarchs that use them as host plants, but they also provide nectar and pollen resources for a number of other pollinators, including our native bees. And when the bees emerge in the spring, they're looking for resources. And of course, some of these early spring flowers, or what we call spring ephemerals, are super important, as are things like willows, like pussy willow, are important resources of pollen and nectar for these bees that are setting up their nests.
In our last minute or so, Amy, I know the goal of the Bee City Project is to inspire people to do things, maybe even in their own backyards, to help bees. What kind of things, simple things, might people who have a little bit of lawn space do to help these native bees of Wisconsin?
Yeah, so one of the main things that people can do in their own yards is grow native plants. Wild bees rely on these resources. They need resources that are staggered over the course of their flight season. So to be sure to include seasonal diversity, a variety of plants, different bees like different types of plants, and some use plants for nectar resource and different ones for pollen. So again, high diversity native plants provide both nesting and overwintering habitat. This could just be leaving bare patches in your lawn, maybe some rodent burrows that they don't fill. Some species of bumblebees like to use those. And then, of course, avoid using pesticide as much as possible. And then encourage your friends, your neighbors, and family to do the same.
Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Very happy to be here.
Amy Wolf is a professor of natural and applied sciences at UW-Green Bay. She talked with us about the school gaining the Bee City USA designation for its work creating habitats for pollinators. I talked to her in April about the project. Coming up, we find out how beginning cooks can set up their first kitchens. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll learn about the history of Memorial Day. First, for many people, setting up their kitchens for the first time ever can be a big task. Some people rush out and buy everything all at once. Others might be overwhelmed by all the products and gadgets on the market. But whether you're setting up your first kitchen or leveling up your current one, our next guest has some advice to make it easier. Lisa Chernick is a food editor. You can find her writings at lisachernick.com. Her latest book is called Your Starter Kitchen, the definitive beginner's guide to stocking, organizing, and cooking in your kitchen. I talked to Lisa about what your kitchen needs on a previous episode of Central Time. Here's our conversation. Well, I'm a big fan of really practical kitchen advice on Food Friday, and you take it right from the beginning. What inspired you to write this book from, the origin of a kitchen to making us into pretty good cooks?
Well, I've been working as a food editor and a food writer for like 20 years or so at this point, and I just feel like I've been carrying around all this information in my head, and the opportunity came up for me to be able to kind of put it all in one place and make it shareable. And that was how the book kind of was born. And, also I'm remembering back to my younger self when I did have my own first apartment, my own first kitchen. And I really wish I would have had a book like this. When I think about all the ridiculous things I thought I needed versus what I've learned about over the years, you realize it's good to have it all written down somewhere, really nice and concise. And that's kind of the essence of the book.
And I love that you start not with, a fancy kitchen we might see on a cooking show, a commercial kitchen setup. You're thinking, among other things, about that person, maybe that college student or person who just moved away from home in a first apartment, maybe with roommates, maybe with limited space. Talk about who you are picturing as you write this book.
Yeah, I think I was picturing, sort of different people at different phases of their lives. And the first and sort of the real starter point for me was that that first time you're away from the kitchen where you grew up, where someone else is in charge and it's all on you. You've got to, you know, open the drawers and realize there's nothing in them until you put the silverware in, the utensils in, the get the pots and the pans and the whole thing. So I wanted it to be something that a person could really hold in their hand and take to a store. Even there's tear out pages, you can do that. And, you know, sort of know that you could go through and get everything that you need and not more than you really need. And then, you know, I also was imagining the person who finally for the first time didn't have roommates anymore and had their own real place for the first time and maybe had a little more space and maybe even a wedding registry, kind of helping to put some of the pieces together for them. So I wanted to also address that and what would make that work best. And I even then went one level further to sort of a forever home where you have maybe more space, more money, more of both, you know, what to get and also what not to get. Cause there's a little of that desire to sort of go a little crazy. And I think sometimes you sort of look around and think, why did I buy that?
Well, let's start with some of the what to get. And you've got a full page checklist of things for that first kitchen, but give us a sense of some of the basics and the kinds of things we're looking for here.
Well, I think it's really important, you know, besides saying, you need like definitely need a skillet, you need a good knife, you need some measuring cups, mixing bowls, things like that. One of the things that I think is important is to also have sort of the planning ahead piece in mind when you're going to embark on a first place with roommates, especially that instead of buying a lot of odds and ends and just quick fixes, each person who's going to be in the roommate situation uses their money to buy one really good thing, one like a really good knife, a really good skillet, and maybe a really great, you know, enameled cast iron Dutch oven pot that they can take, because all of those kinds of things you'll be able to take with you for your whole cooking lifetime. And, you know, maybe the year after this roommate group goes its separate ways, everybody gets to come away with something good and, you know, not just a bunch of chip plates that nobody really wants to have to drag with them to the next apartment anyway. So that's kind of, you know, one helpful thing. And, you know, I think just keeping it simple, but keeping it essential. A few pans will really do the trick. One really good knife. And if you're going to get a second, make it the chef's knife first and a paring knife second. And you don't need a whole lot. That's kind of the big, like, ta-da.
We're talking to food editor Lisa Chernick about her book, Your Starter Kitchen, The Definitive Beginner's Guide to Stocking, Organizing, and Cooking in Your Kitchen. Lisa, let's talk about those don'ts a little bit. How can we evaluate that cool looking device or gadget or what have you and figure out, am I really going to need that?
You know, I think one of the things that's really irresistible is the gadget aisle in the home goods store, and everything just is so seductive. Like, of course I want that cherry pitter so bad, and look at that cool thing to cut an avocado or whatever it might be. And it's really, I think it really gets people, I don't know, they just get revved up. They just want to buy a lot of those things. I think it's hard to hold back and say, oh, you know, I probably could do most of these things if I had a good knife, really. But I think that single use gadgets are super seductive and they're exactly what you don't need to clutter up your drawers and your small amount of cooking space. You know, a really good cutting board, really good knife, you know, the cookware, and those are the basics.
Now, you don't just talk about the gear and the gadgets and the things we need to buy. You also talk about some good starter techniques to learn in the kitchen for that maybe first time cooking on their own cook with the basic material. What are some good starting points?
Well, some good starting points. I think it's important to also, you know, to address a few techniques that people, I think, feel like are almost a given, you know, how to really cook eggs the right way. That's harder than you think it is. I think people think it should somehow just be innate knowledge and they can just walk into the kitchen and do it and it's going to come out great. But it actually is pretty simple, but you do need to follow certain instructions. And I have a little egg section because I think that's one of the ones that gets people. But, you know, I think with certain things are really simple. Like one of the things that's, it's not really a technique per se, but it's just like a sort of a rule. And it makes such a big difference is just salting the water properly when you're cooking pasta, for example, or if you're going to blanch vegetables, and then just seasoning things properly as you go with salt and pepper. People, I think, really underestimate the impact that those simple things will have on the end result of what they make. And it's kind of just astounding when you do it. You're like, oh, I had no idea. It's so much better now.
You share some recipes in addition to the techniques in the book, and you've shared one with us. We've got this at WPR.org/Food Friday. You've got a good, solid, classic roasted chicken. And I know it's really easy to roast chicken badly to where it's, you know, dry, rubbery, whatever. What's the secret to a well-roasted chicken?
I think one of the main secrets, if you want to call it a secret, first of all, one of the few gadgets that I absolutely love and I think everybody should have is an instant read thermometer. And so basically, once you've set up your chicken, and to be honest, the way my recipe reads, and this is truly from the heart, because this is the way that I do it, simple salt and pepper with some herbs thrown into the cavity if you have them. If you don't, it's not going to really create a problem. But if you do it at the right temperature, and you check for doneness at the right time, and you don't overcook it, it's just going to come out this beautiful roast that everybody who's going to be at your table with you is going, oh my gosh, that's amazing. How did you do that? And sometimes it's what you don't do. It's, you know what I mean? You don't need to have a lot of complicated ingredients to make any kind of a special rub or a special anything. It's really following some simple rules, I think, more than anything, and using that that thermometer to get the cooking temperature correct and not going too far, because I think sometimes people just are guessing, you know, especially with something like a whole chicken. It's hard to tell. You're supposed to put that thermometer into the, you know, the thigh at the thickest part, then you get your read, and then you know you're good to go.
I'll second that on the thermometer. You have that on your essentials for the starter kitchen. I treated it as optional and in consequence, cooking meat, I always erred on the side of caution. And so I always erred on the side of, you know, kind of overdone. So it's actually maybe cook meat less now.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's true. That if it doesn't come out the way you're kind of picturing in your mind before you start the recipe, you're like, eh, I don't think I like that. I'm not going to do that again. So there it is.
We're listening to my conversation from last year with writer Lisa Chernick. She's the author of Your Starter Kitchen, the definitive beginner's guide to stocking, organizing, and cooking in your kitchen. Coming up, we'll hear about the best ways to merge collections of pots and pans, and we learn about some single-use gadgets that are handier than you'd think. And if you have advice to share for the first-time kitchen owner, let us know. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. What do you have to have? What can you skip? That's at Central Time WPR on Twitter. We'll hear the rest of the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're finding out how to stock our kitchens, especially if you're just starting out or if someone you know is. Lisa Chernick joined us last year. Lisa is the author of the book Your Starter Kitchen, the definitive beginner's guide to stocking, organizing, and cooking in your kitchen. Now we listen to the second half of our conversation. Kicking it off, we hear from Morgan in Baraboo, who called in to talk about a favorite and unexpected piece of gear.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to make a suggestion. I noticed your caller had mentioned something about single-use items. There was one thing I bought off of a Kickstarter. It's called a PB Jife. Like PBJ Ife. It was invented just to get peanut butter out without getting any peanut butter on your fingers. But I've been able to use it for almost anything that you have a deep jar or something you can't quite get with, like that spoon to get the last bit of frosting out. It's been one of the tools that I bought for peanut butter jelly sandwiches, but I've used it for like almost everything in my kitchen. Just a handy little tool.
Interesting, Morgan. Thanks a lot for the call. Lisa, evaluating those limited use things, it's kind of situational. I used to do a lot of canning of tomatoes. I bought a little thing called a tomato shark that helped you core it. It was great. When I stopped canning, it was the most useless item in my house. How do we judge our unique needs? Like if we're going to eat a lot of peanut butter, maybe that device isn't such a bad idea.
Oh yeah, totally. I feel like it's absolutely connected to how often you're going to use it. I think I even talk about things that, you know, if you're really going to be making souffles frequently, by all means, get that souffle dish and, you know, go for it, get a beautiful one. You know, like if you're going to make a trifle for dessert and, you know, you're going to do this over and over again. Absolutely. But If it's something that you're just trying that you might do once or twice, if that, you know, I was sort of jokingly referring to the fondue set, you know, if you make fondue, it's great. But if you're going to have it once, maybe twice ever, yeah, maybe you don't need to do that. But I feel like your caller really kind of nailed it though. If something doesn't take up a lot of space and it's really something you find to be useful, you just hit the jackpot. So that's a win.
Thanks a lot for that call. John joins us now in Madison. John, hi.
Hi, my girlfriend and I just moved to the east side, and we're looking at pots and pans to get. Hopefully, we want a ceramic set of pots and pans, but we're kind of wondering what brand we should go with, something we don't really want to make the wrong decision on.
Thanks a lot for the call, John. First of all, a brand, but also if you can give us a sense of the range of pans we might want, the basics we want to make sure we have.
Well, I feel like one thing I want to say is I think having a nonstick pan, and if you buy ceramic, I don't know if you're thinking of this sort of ceramic nonstick finish, or if you mean something different, but I think something nonstick is great. And I think everybody should have a really good nonstick skillet. And if possible, even sort of a small one to cook like an egg or two, and then a larger one to do something bigger, like, you know, if you're going to be cooking chicken. I think that's very helpful, but I also think people should not get too crazy on the nonstick. I think it's really easy for the surface to get damaged and for it to be just not the greatest pan. I think the other essential is to have a really good large, and again, small, and this is what I have, you know, really good stainless steel skillet. And I feel like, you know, a big one that could hold maybe 4 chicken breasts is, I guess that's probably like a 10 or a 12 inch even, and then something smaller. And the other great pan, and some people love cast iron, just straight up cast iron pans. I'm a really big fan of the enameled cast iron. I have one as like a fry pan, and then I have those, you know, those larger Dutch oven pans that you can move right from the stovetop into the oven, and you could do like braises and things. So, you know, those, it's difficult to say the right size. I guess it depends on whether you're loving really large scale cooking and you're doing giant batches of sauces or braises. And in which case, you know, go for it, get the really big one, but they tend to be pricey. So sometimes I sort of think you might have to start with one that's maybe the 5-quart, and you can always go big, go to the 7 or the 9. If, you know, if you're setting up a wedding registry, then you're go for it.
And John, I wanted to ask, are the two of you completely starting from scratch, or do you have kind of your own mishmash of materials and you're partly merging, partly adding new stuff?
We definitely have a mishmash. Right now, I think our pantry consists of a stock pot and 2 cast iron pans. So I don't know if that's good enough or if we still need to get the whole pots and pans set.
Interesting. So maybe they don't need a whole huge set, Lisa. Maybe just a couple few key things, it sounds like.
I think just a few add-ons and you could probably make a go of it. The 2 cast iron pans, that's exciting. You could really, you know, you could have a whole fried chicken thing going on. You could take up the whole stove and just be, you know, frying chicken in your cast irons. I feel like just a few extras and you're going to be where you need. The stock pot, you could do a lot. I don't know how tall your stock pot is, but you know, you could certainly do pasta in that. I like something a little shorter. So maybe get something that's a little bit smaller, like a 6-quart pot. I would do that. Maybe a skillet or two more in different sizes. I'm not sure what sizes your cast irons are, but just kind of, you know, not so much for the material being different, but just to have different sizes. I think that's very helpful.
Lisa, you also give some advice on stocking up the pantry, the sort of basic cooking materials that we'll want to have on that are going to be flexible, we use for a lot of different recipes. What are a couple of the keys there?
Well, I feel like, you know, you want to have a decent array of, you know, sort of, you want some oil, definitely have a nice olive oil on hand, but then, you know, something neutral as well so that you don't have a problem going and cooking on high heat, because, you know, as some people know, the olive oils and some of the more, you know, delicate oils will start smoking at a lower temperature, and it'll just create a bad result overall. Your oil will start to burn. But I feel like having a couple of different oils, even having nonstick spray, if you tend to, you know, just do that one or two single eggs for breakfast in the morning, that's very helpful. You know, the vinegar, some basic herbs and spices. You don't have to go crazy by any means. I'm a fan of also keeping a few baking basics on hand at all times, because I think sometimes people are kind of, you know, suddenly taken with the whim of like, oh, let's make cookies. And it doesn't take much if you have the flour, sugar, baking soda, baking powder, and some chocolate chips. You're kind of there ready to roll. You know, maybe just need to pick up butter and eggs if you don't have them. So I think some baking basics are really nice to keep on hand. Again, don't get the giant, largest bag of flour if you've got a small kitchen, but, you know, keep a little bit on hand.
We got an email from Susan in Williams Bay. She gave some advice similar to some of what you've had to say, getting the basic appliances. You can live without the fancier stuff, have good quality gadgets and utensils, she says. And I like this point. Susan says, maximize your counter space. Don't clutter it up with stuff. What do you think of that part of the advice?
So smart. So smart. I feel like, you know, one of the reasons that the overdoing the gadgets, and especially if they're small electronics, is that suddenly you don't have any prep space left on the counter. They're all lined up, taking up the whole space that you should be able to put a cutting board and, you know, like a bowl for what you're cutting. So I am 100% with her. I think she's totally right. If you really can't fit it's kind of almost like the same thing with your clothing. Like if you don't have the drawer space, you kind of have to stop. You just can't buy any more stuff. If your counter's cluttered, you just have to stop.
Time for one more caller. Molly is on the line in Chicago. Molly, hi.
Hi. I think that one of the basics, if you're starting out, is a can opener that also can open the bottle. And then I think a serrated knife is a smart thing because it also does tomatoes, as well as breads and whatever. It's kind of an add-on. A vegetable peeler, cheap and easy, and one basic cookbook. There are times when, you know, a time-tested, like Joy of Cooking or something, when you need some simple answer, and instead of looking up all recipes or whatever on your computer, you just can get it fast.
Molly, thanks a lot for the call. I love that advice. And actually, I still have a Betty Crocker cookbook, one of the classic ones my aunt gave me when I first moved out on my own. And I still make, you know, the apple crisp and some of the other stuff out of that. One good cookbook, Lisa.
Yeah, well, you know, I think Joy of Cooking is great. And it's always, you know, they keep doing interesting revisions over the years as time goes on. So I feel like that's a great one. Marcella Hazan's Essentials of Italian Cooking, if you kind of like your cooking to go in that direction, she's got all the basics for Italian. That's been on my shelves forever. I have a lot that I like to go to all the time, though. I'm sorry.
That's fine.
My cookbook shelves need to be thinned out. So,
all right. Well, maybe that's another conversation, how to weed out all the extra stuff in our kitchens. Lisa, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
That was Lisa Chernick. She's a food editor, and you can find her writings at lisachernick.com. Her latest book is Your Starter Kitchen, the definitive beginner's guide to stocking, organizing, and cooking in your kitchen. She joined us last year to help us set our kitchens up for success, from our early starter kitchens to our forever kitchens. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Join Kate Archer Kent each weekday for a look at the top news of the day in Wisconsin and beyond, and great discussions about health, culture, and more. And you can join the conversation. Join the morning show each weekday from 6 to 9. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll learn more about the history of Memorial Day with historian Ken Davis. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.